Hi, I'm Henat Baba, host of Cross Currents. Just a few times a year, we ask for your support, and now is the time to do that. It's our spring membership campaign. So if you like what you hear on KALW, make a contribution now at KALW.org and click donate. Thank you.
KALW.
It's stuff that's worth knowing about that will help steer you in your own steps as you go through life.
An urban park is both a recreational escape and a historical record.
We want to make sure that we keep Aquatic Park for the people in the future.
Today, the past, present, and future of San Francisco's Aquatic Park. Then one man reflects on how he avoided incarceration by fleeing the state and building a new life across the country.
She holds up the newspaper and it said Merced Sun Star. And then the front page, it says that I'm wanted. I genuinely thought that it was over with, but I was on the run.
I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. With its Depression-era structures and historical vessels, San Francisco's Aquatic Park is home to countless memories for some visitors. For others, it's a place to get sunshine, fresh air, and recreation. Reporter Andrew St. Singh took a trip there to understand how these competing interests are shaping the park's future.
Alcatraz, Golden Gate Bridge, bad tours there.
I'm at Fisherman's Wharf, headed for Pier 45. I've come to this strip of commercial fishing warehouses to meet Kirk Lombard, the founder of the sustainable seafood company Sea Forager. When I walk up to him, his whole crew has gathered around to be informed and or entertained by his slightly exaggerated thoughts on the dangers of late season crabbing.
People die.
Oh, wow. That's
crazy. I mean, these guys are out there, it's like, crab pots swing. I mean, what's that, 125 pounds, 150 pounds? Yeah, he's stepping away.
Kirk's also an educator, and he used to lead tours of local fishing spots. I'm here to talk to him about the municipal pier in Aquatic Park, just a couple blocks away from Sea Forager's warehouse. The public pier had been free to use and popular with recreational fishers. But it was closed in 2022 because of damage that's left it structurally unsound. After he's done talking to his crew, Kirk and I walk over to Aquatic Park. On the way, he recalls fishing off the Muni.
Often when I worked as a fisheries checker, when my shift ended, I would go out to the Muni Pier and I would chill out. And I think I only ever caught leopard sharks, and stingrays, bat rays, always threw them back. But then I had some monster days fishing surf perch there, rubber lips and black perch and pile perch, white perch. Off the pilings, you can catch these little bait perch called shiners. It was a really fun pier. I miss it.
As we leave the street and enter the park, we walk past the white wood-paneled building that houses the Dolphin and Southend Rowing Clubs. Members of both athletic organizations have been swimming and rowing in the area for more than 100 years. Here, Kirk and I have a good view of Muni Pier. The arcing concrete structure curves east from the western end of Aquatic Park, partially separating the water in the cove from the rest of the bay.
Now, my one criticism of this pier as a fishing place is that the pilings are kind of blocked. You see where the water line is? It doesn't go all the way through.
The pier incorporates a baffle system that shelters Aquatic Park Cove. Concrete slabs break the tide and keep the water inside calm for swimmers and rowers. That might explain why Diane Walton, the president of the Dolphin Club, is more enthusiastic about the baffle system than Kirk is. She's been regularly swimming and rowing in the cove for years now. Standing at the locked gate that currently blocks access to Muni Pier, she tells me, with a conspiratorial smile.
Yeah, you can actually go down underneath it. There's a pathway that you can take a kayak
don't know if you're supposed to.
Anyway, but it's really kind of thrilling just to see those slabs and the action against them. So yeah, it's really an engineering marvel, and we need it for the beauty of it, for the grace of it, but also for the protection.
Diane sees repairing Muni Pier and its baffle system as essential for the park's continued existence as a recreational space. As president of the Dolphin Club, Diane feels responsibility as a steward of this space.
We were here when it was built, and we're proud of that. And we want to make sure that that we keep Aquatic Park for the people in the future.
But the Dolphin Club isn't in charge of the space. All Diane can do is advocate for the repairs she believes are necessary. Right now, the estimated cost of repairing the pier exceeds $100 million, and no one knows where that money will come from. Muni Pier is part of the San Francisco Maritime National Historical Park, and although the National Park Service received funding for this park through 2020's Great American Outdoors Act, it opted to repair Hyde Street Pier instead. Hyde Street Pier sticks straight out from Aquatic Park Cove's eastern end, just behind the Dolphin and South End rowing clubhouses. This is where the National Park Service docks its historic vessels, so that visitors can access them. Near the shore, a seagull perches on the bowsprit of a wood-hulled schooner that used to carry lumber. At the far end of the pier, ramps slope down to waterline platforms where sea lions congregate and sailors pressure wash their small boats. But I'm interested in the middle stretch of the pier, where a steam-powered ferry boat floats opposite a three-masted steel-hulled square rigger. Both massive vessels held in place by thick, groaning chains. For bespectacled ranger Christopher Edwards, these boats are what the park is all about. Decked out in his uniform and armed with a tablet full of historical images, he's got something to show me on the square rigger.
On board the Valclutha, thought we might start to down below deck, highlight one of the programs that's focused on the last career of the ship, which is kind of an undertold story.
The Balclutha launched in the late 19th century, and much of the structure has been restored to reflect its original form, when it frequently carried goods around South America's Cape Horn. But in the early 20th century, a San Francisco-based fishing conglomeration called the Alaska Packers Association bought the vessel and refitted it to transport cannery workers north to can salmon and bring it back south. Christopher takes me to a narrow room near the front of the boat. There are 15 wooden bunks lining the walls, three rows of three on one side and two rows of three on the other. On one of the bunks, there's an informational placard with a button for immersive audio. Christopher shows me a historical blueprint of the ship on his tablet.
So the reason I brought us down below deck, and I'm showing you this drawing here, is that this was for the cannery workers, and you'll notice it says Oriental's quarters.
Christopher brings visitors here to start discussions about how the Alaska Packers trapped Chinese immigrants and other people of color in a system of debt peonage, using tactics like those employed by white Southerners against black sharecroppers after the Civil War. Sometimes visitors engage.
But the challenge is always fishermen's work, because people are, they're here in the area because they want their Bodine's bread bowl with clam chowder. They don't want to deal with social responsibility and heavy-duty, hard-to-appreciate pieces of history that are not positive. It's stuff that's worth knowing about that will help steer you in your own steps as you go through life.
Back above deck, near the captain's quarters, I asked Christopher about Muni Pier. He says the government only has so much funding, and the projects here on Hyde Street Pier are massive undertakings in and of themselves. He can't say officially what will happen, but personally,
I'm looking forward to the day that that gets the TLC that it really needs. Not just because it's a great place to experience and for locals to go, but it's part of the WPA story of how this whole cove area got developed, including the Maritime Museum.
In the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration took over construction of Aquatic Park Cove, Muni Pier, and the nautically inspired bathhouse building that would become the Maritime Museum. The city of San Francisco had started the project at the behest of its citizens, including members of the Dolphin Club, who wanted to clean up their polluted swimming spot. But the federal government had to step in when money got tight during the Great Depression. That history might explain why Diane Walton is confident that advocates like her will succeed in their mission to find an alternative source of funding for the Muni Pier repairs. After all, it's been done before. Diane thinks it's just a matter of reminding people in leadership of how spectacular this living piece of history truly is. We stand together on the Cove's beach and look out at Alcatraz and Angel Island, reaching up from the dark blue bay towards the low clouds resting on the rolling green hills to the north.
Imagine if you came here from somewhere else, I don't know where else, and you got to be in the middle of this. How could you not be thrilled?
In San Francisco, I'm Andrew Saintsing for Cross Currents.
Andrew is a graduate of our Audio Academy. You can find more of his work online at klw.org/crosscurrents. And applications are now open for the next Audio Academy. So if you're interested in our tuition-free program that teaches you how to tell sound-rich audio stories, then head to klw.org/audioacademy for details on how to apply. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Many years ago, Javier Serna committed a crime that would change his life. He's in prison in San Quentin now, but before he was arrested, he fled California. And for over a decade, he created a new life in hiding with a new family and his own business. Uncuffed producer Ryan Pagan spoke with Javier about his years spent on the run. He shares what he learned about himself and the kind of man he hopes to be in the future.
First thing when I wake up in the morning, grab my phone, check the time, ready to get up. I get up, go brush my teeth, wash my face. It seems like a normal day. So I come home from work. My girl approaches me with a newspaper and she asks me, what's this about? She holds up the newspaper and then the front page, it says that I'm wanted. I genuinely thought that it was over with, but I was on the run. Back in 2006, there was a crime committed and I was involved in, so I left. I left the state and they caught me barely 3 years ago. I was born in Merced, raised in Winton. Winton's a little town, it's a bunch of woods, like almond fields, peach fields, sweet potato fields. It was kind of rough, you know. There's a lot of gang activity there. You gotta be careful what you're wearing. If you're wearing the wrong color, sometimes they won't even confront you. They'll just come and shoot you. I joined the gang because you pretty much got to be from a gang there to survive while you're young. You got to do a crime, you know, to fit in. If you don't do the crime, you pretty much, you're not part of them. I started doing drugs, drinking and smoking weed, doing cocaine, dope, a little bit of everything. I got into it with some people and they were trying to kill me. So I went out there and got a gun to protect myself and I ended up getting encounters with the person and before he shot at me, I shot at him and I got him. He survived, you know, I just got him in the arm. That's when I bought a Greyhound ticket and I took off to North Carolina because I did not want to deal with the cops. Like that, I could get away from everything. Everything could calm down and I could come back and fix whatever was going on, you know. First, it was hard. In North Carolina, it's very different. You get homesick because it's different. It's a whole different environment. Then after I got a job out there and I started working, I started getting used to it. No, I ended up meeting a girl that had three kids, and I had changed, you know, just working, coming home to her and the kids, and life was good. I was in North Carolina for about 4 to 5 years. And then that's when I got pulled over by the cops in a checkpoint. When I got pulled over that day, I said, oh my God. The blood went from my head to my toes. I went cold. I was freaked out. Right away, I turned to my girlfriend. I gave her the money I had in my wallet. I said, here, you're going to need it more than I am. She's like, don't worry about it. You're good. I said, nah, $2,000-$3,000 ain't going to get me out of jail. Not for what I'm going for. She didn't know nothing about what was going on. But I did get very scared. I didn't know what to do. All I did was just hold on to the steering wheel, give him my ID, give him the papers of the truck, and that was it. He went back to his car, and I was about to punch the gas, man. I was scared. I was like, man. And then I looked back, and I had the kids with me, and I'm like, man, if I wouldn't have the kids, I would have stepped on it. It wouldn't be the first time. As soon as the cop came back, he was like, hey, go get your license, and we'll dismiss the ticket. And I was like, thank God. I must not have a warrant in California anymore. That after that, I went and got my license. I actually kind of like brushed it off. It's all good now. Right after that, I was getting $11 an hour. As soon as I knew I had my ID and papers, I went to $16 an hour. Started working on the constructions with my papers now, because I wasn't working my ID or nothing. I was working under a fake social security and ID. Well, you know how Mexicans are. We could get them easy. A year and a half before I got incarcerated, I started my own business. I ended up learning how to do that fencing, chain link fencing. One of my brothers, they mailed me the newspaper, and I had it for a couple of years. And my girl actually found it one time, and she's like, what is this? And I was like, what? Oh, you found the newspaper? She's like, yeah, you're wanted for this crime. And I said, look, I told her, read right. It says wanted for questioning. She's like, yeah, but you're still wanted. And I'm like, well, no, I'm not, because I got my license. Look, I got all this. You know what I mean? I even got a gun permit, you know? So it's like, they checked my background for my gun permit. They checked my background for my license, you know? They checked everything, so I did not have no warrants or nothing. So I said, don't worry about it, you know? It's nothing no more. When I got arrested, that day I went to work. It was a normal day, like every other day, go to work. I drank a couple of beers right after work. So I was driving home, and I was just speeding. The cop pulled me over. Right away, he said, any weapons or anything in the car? I told him, yeah, I got a 45 in my glove compartment. It's registered under my name. So he made me step out of the vehicle. And as soon as he told me, blow on this, which I think is a breathalyzer, I told him, no, sir, I'm not going to blow on it. I'm not drunk. So right away, he said, you're arrested. And I told him why. He said, because you refuse to blow on the breathalyzer. If I would have known, I would have blown on it. But, well, after that, he just booked me in. As soon as I was right there waiting for like 20 minutes, he comes back in and then he tells me, he gives me a paper and says, you got a warrant for attempted murder in California. And I told him, no way. So how could I have attempted murder in California with a gun permit, license, and everything here? I said, man, you guys must got the wrong person. But as soon as I seen the picture, I knew it was me. I knew I was gonna come here for a long time. You know, I'm an adult now, so, you know, like in my mind, I'm set, you know, whenever I get out, I'm gonna go back to tracking the same steps I was doing. That company I had, I'm gonna build it up again, and hopefully, you know, this time I could do a lot more than I was able to when I was just starting, you know. After moving over there, there's no more gangs and there's no more nothing like that. So it's more like you focus to your family. You got to support them, you know, because no matter what, dude, those kids got to eat. You know what I mean? Your girlfriend has to eat. You know, the vehicles need gas. I learned to become a man and be responsible, especially after where I got with my girlfriend and the kids. I learned to be a responsible parent, you know. You could do good out there, man. You just got to get out of the bad environment you're in.
That story from Uncuffed was produced by Ryan Pagan. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and listeners like you. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.